So, as the strains of Read or Die fade away, you're listening to Brave New Words. I'm your host, Ed Fortune, and I'm here with...
I'm Ross.
I'm Del.
I'm Anne.
On today's show, we're talking about Sherlock Holmes, and specifically, we're going to start off talking about Sherlock Holmes and the Servant of Hell! And yes, I do have to say it that way. But coming up next, a very quick advert.
Starburst Radio. The greatest radio show in the universe. Every Wednesday, 9 p.m. till 11 p.m. Exclusive to Fab Radio International.
That was a very quick advert.
It was very quick.
We have to have ID's and things so people know it's on the radio. By the way, if you're listening to us on the podcast, we're also on the radio. You can catch us every Sunday at 12 to 1 on fabradiointernational.com. But mostly, you can find us on Stitcher. As Brave New Words via the Monkey Spanner website, or you can find us on the Starburst magazine website via iTunes. You can also read the regular column Brave New Words. It's almost as if we have a whole brand thing going on in Starburst magazine, which is on the shelves of all good news agents. So I like to think that news agents are sort of like spies, they're like secret agents. They run around and kind of like, you know, to get copies of newspapers, they have to go on special adventures. It's like an agent of the news. That would be a journalist, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I have in my hands Sherlock Holmes and the Servants of Hell. Now, you might not recognise this as an original Conan Doyle novel, because it's not an original Conan Doyle novel.
That'll be why, then.
Well, the thing happened, most of the Sherlock Holmes stuff is out of copyright.
Yeah.
And has been for a while. And now all of the Sherlock Holmes stuff is out of copyright. Because what happened originally was there was a small number of stuff that was still under the weird American copyright laws. Because American copyright laws are a bit weird because they're still trying to hang on to Mickey Mouse for some weird reason. Who cares about Mickey Mouse these days? Disney. Oh, yes. So they're still, you know, they're still trying to kind of hang on to Mickey Mouse. So there was a whole thing where people were like, well, you should still pay rights for Sherlock Holmes. And that was thrown out of court after. So basically, the upshot of that is there was a big court case, and it's free range on the rights, pretty much. Someone who's more legally minded will probably leap on me and go, no, it's more nuanced than that. And feel free, Twitter at Radio Bookworm, tell us all about it. We love your feedback, especially when I'm wrong. So there's been loads of... We did touch on this a little while ago. There's been loads of kind of mix-ups and remixes. 221B Baker Street was one of the ones we particularly liked, where they had lots of different short stories and dimensions. We talked about the old Baker Street. And you've been storing Sherlock Holmes stories for a while now, haven't you? Like, kind of alternate ones that we've got.
Yeah, yeah. My To Be Read pal has about six variants of Sherlock AUs of one form or another on it. It's getting out of hand.
We've talked about Warlock Holmes.
Oh,
as
yeah.
Well, yeah. And that came up in the Judging a Book by Its Cover episode. I'm sure that was one of the ones we pulled out of the box.
And then Alt Sherlock's, which was like a bunch of novellas.
That's one of the ones on the To Be Read pal.
But that's none of those. We've also got Sherlock in Space one that we recently acquired at Edgeley.
In Space! Yeah. But that's the only thing that your head does, though, isn't it? Because as soon as you said it, my head did go, Sherlock in Space! Like, it is. You can't say it any other way.
But anyway, so we've got...
I feel slightly disappointed that the Sherlock part of these titles doesn't get its own... way of saying it, you know. In Space does it, and the Servants of Hell does, but you know, not Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock in Space. In Space, but we're not talking about Sherlock in Space. We're talking about Sherlock in Hell. That's got its own thing. Because it's Hell. Hell.
I think I should have a drum beat after it.
So,
wasn't that the EastEnders drum beat though?
No.
Okay.
Yes.
That's slightly different.
Okay.
Doom 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 doom. See, you can hear the difference though.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
What's really
EastEnders, Mistrons, you know, subtle.
What's really impressive is when you say that, it sounds like an actual drum beat. It's really, really, really clever. Sherlock Holmes and the Servants of Hell is a book by Paul Keane, inspired by the works of Clive Barker. Paul Keane is a first-rate storyteller. Clive Barker, the cover, and you should never book, judge a book by its cover, unless you do, which most people do, has the Deerstalker and the pipe of Sherlock Holmes.
They're kind of famous silhouettes.
A famous silhouette that fans of the works were like, you never wore Deerstalker. It's like, yeah, but we know what that symbol means.
What are they called, those pictures from the Victorian times that were just a black...
Cameos.
Cameos, that's yeah. it. So it's the famous Sherlock cameo.
Well, he would have worn it, so that he was in the countryside at the time. Well, he would, but usually he was a city detective because he lived in the city.
What makes a cameo in this book are the creatures from Clive Barker's Hellraiser stories. Because the cameo is on a puzzle box. If you know what the Le Marchand configuration is, then you're going to be bored about the next 10 seconds because I'm going to explain it. Le Marchand configuration is a puzzle box. It's black and gold. It's pretty. It's very, very pretty. And then when you see it, you go, that's very pretty. I wonder what's in it. And you really want to know what's in the box. You can't help yourself but want to know what's in the box. And if you're a certain sort of person, if you've got hungers, you know, if you've got that sort of curiosity that can't be sated, or a lust or desire that can't be sated, you really want to know what's in the box. It really appeals to you. And you spend ages trying to get the box open. And the book opens with someone spending ages trying to get the box open. And they've not slept for a while, and they've got themselves in a room, and they've been obsessing about getting this box open, trying to get the box open, and trying to. And they're just sitting there. It's implied that they're pretty much naked in a room, bare stripped room on their own, the door's locked, and a constant kind of concentration to. And they've been doing this for a while, they've been trying to get in the box, and they're obsessed with the box, and trying to open the box. And then they vanish. Because as fans of the Hellraiser movies know, that once you open the box, the servants of hell come out and drag you in chains and strip and tear you apart until there is nothing left of you except pain and pleasure.
So being intrigued by a box is now a hell-worthy trespass?
It's a horrible magic box. It's a specific evil magic box. And each move is supposed to be pleasurable and supposed to... And you know what you're doing is the wrong thing. It's like some enormous metaphor for temptation. You know, like, you know, every single move you're making, you're like, this is a terrible idea. Click. I really shouldn't be doing this. Click, click. Until it starts working on its own. Pop. So the story opens with someone in a room trying to open the box. Mr. Cotton, Mr. Frank Cotton, and if you know the Hellraiser movie, then you know who Mr. Frank Cotton is. What happens next, of course, is there's a lot of mystery. The man's gone missing. So, well, what do? You're in Victorian England. Someone that you care about has gone missing.
Who are you going to call?
Holmes and Watson, obviously.
Sherlock Holmes.
The story is set after the Reichenbach fall. So he has come back. So Reichenbach's happened, he has returned. This is written from both Watson and Holmes' perspective. It starts just Watson, and then eventually you get Holmes' perspective as well, for a variety of reasons.
Is it perspective, or is it written in the style of the original stories, which were Watson recounting stories as to his publisher?
It starts. What Watson does is he explains. So he's explaining this particular tale. At the very start, Paul Kane lampshades the fact that this is a crossover. So he's like, "This is the last." You know, with Watson going, "This is the last home story I will ever relate to you, because it's so outside the realms of what you're expecting that you'll think I'm insane. This is a crazy story." And I'm sure, you know, and it's clearly being written by an elderly Watson, and Paul Kane totally lampshades it by going, yes, and I can already see that other people are writing stories about Holmes, almost as if he wasn't a real person. And I'm slightly offended by that, but there's not much I can do about it. And I expect that people will write stories, and then, you know, lists a series of crossovers that you have definitely seen recently, and you're like, Nice lampshading. Okay, so
does it mention the Moffat Gattis and the
set in what?
Johnny Miller Elementary.
Set in the future, maybe even set in the colony.
Oh,
set in the 22nd century.
Not specifically, just the future.
Okay.
So yeah, he kind of is. This is the thing that Paul Kane's done, is he's very cleverly laced this entire book with Sherlock Holmes Easter eggs. So there's little references to Sherlock Holmes movie and novel, movie and story mythos. The other mythos he's dealing with is Clive Barker's Hellraiser. There's two takes on the whole Xenobites, the pin-headed monsters are called Xenobites. There's two takes on Xenobites. There's Clive Barker's version, and there's the movie version. The movie version, the first movie came out, everyone was like, that's horrible. Second movie came out, they went, well, that's quite good. And then by the third or fourth movie out, it was just like, I think it's like 9 or 10 Hellraiser movies. There's way too many, and they're a bit, you know, they get a bit pants towards the end. Paulkin desperately wants to have all of his cake and eat all of his cake, which probably would get him dragged off to hell by his Xenobites. So what we have is we have lots of references to the Clive Barker world and the Clive Barker mythos. There's an absolutely lovely bit, which is unfortunately a spoiler, where one of the characters turns around and says, I've had enough. It's not Watson or Holmes, but one of the kind of peripheral characters goes, I've had enough, I'm off to New York and to do this thing. And then you go, hang on a minute, isn't that a character from another Clive Barker novel? Isn't that how that starts? Well done. Mm. It's full of little... You know, I put the book down at that point and I'm just like, yeah, very well done. And it all kind of traces back. There is a bit towards the very end where it's not a spoiler. There's lots of demon monsters towards the end because it's Sherlock Holmes and the Servants of Hell, where Paul Kane essentially goes through his shopping list of like, here are a bunch of Xenobites from various works of fiction, from the movies and from collected works connected to Clive Barker's Hellraiser. And there's like a page and a half of like, this monster looks like this and has this and carries this. And you're like, that's kind of cool. And if I was really into it, I'd be really impressed. But yeah, then he gets over his shopping list and it's only a page and a half and then it carries on. And you're like, okay, no, that's fine. It's like, it's like having a massive fan suddenly sits in the corner halfway through the book and goes, eee! At you, and then continues on. Does this work as a Sherlock Holmes crossover? Yeah, actually, he gets Holmes' voice pretty... You know, the idea that Holmes is vulnerable to, you know, would be resistant to most magical enchantment, except when you go, here is a box that contains all the knowledge of the world ever. Didn't you want to escape death? Don't you want to know how you escaped death? Don't you want to know how you survived writing back? And one of the ideas that Paul Kane plays with is that Sherlock's not entirely sure either how he survived.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm. And there's a whole... So it's like, here is his thing. Mm. Watson is stalwart all the way through. He gets Watson perfectly right. There is this wonderful bit where Holmes goes, well, why didn't you do that thing? And he's like, you must know that I'm not going to let a horrible thing happen to a person. I'm never going to do that. I'm always going to... He's like, but it was the wrong thing to do. He's like, no, it was the right thing to do. It's the stupid thing to do, sort of thing. And yeah, they don't really have that conversation. It's kind of just implied. Mm. It's fun for what it is. As a Sherlock novel, as a Sherlock spin-off novel, it's kind of fun. As a piece of Clive Barker horror, well, it's not Clive Barker, it's Paul Kane. And it goes, therefore, for the gross out. Is it a good Sherlock spin-off? Yes. Is it as good as Scarlet Gospels? No. Absolutely not. It's nowhere near the level of Hellbound Heart, and it's nowhere near the level of the Scarlet Gospels. But it's not meant to be. Clive Barker's Hellbound Heart, which is the big book that explains everything about Xenobites and all of that horror mythos, is meant to give you nightmares, and it will give you nightmares. This won't give you nightmares. This will make you grin in a slightly grim sort of way, and it's a horror action adventure. The Sherlock Holmes and the Servants of Hell. is fun horror movie brain candy in the same way that the good Hellraiser movies are. I would compare it to the good Hellraiser movies. I wouldn't compare it. It's totally unfair to compare it to Clive Barker, who is a genius of horror, working in his idiom, compared to Paul Kane, who's an excellent horror writer, who is trying to mix two masters together to create something new. As a job of remixing Conan Doyle and Clive Barker, he does remarkably well. And, you know, well done for even taking that challenge on. Because Paul Kane's clearly in something that he wants to play in, but not playing to his own strengths as a writer. If you've read any of other Paul Kane stuff, he's a brilliant writer in his own right. He does very well capturing the essence of two very different writers. But yeah, that's that. It's kind of...
I think I have, like, two kind of questions based on what you said, really. The first one is, because it sounds like, from what you've said, this isn't just a story of Sherlock solving a mystery. This sounds like it's Sherlock solving a mystery, then solving the problem, almost. Because in my head, he'd be like, yeah, he's taken by monsters. But actually now, if he's actually dealing with these monsters, and does he actually try and go further than that? So it's also like bring the person back, rather than just be like, so this is what's happened.
You can escape hell. In Clive Barker's world, you cannot always escape hell.
Okay.
There is always a price to pay.
Okay.
You might not be willing to pay it. And so I'm trying to avoid...
not spoilering, but...
But if you know the movies, then you're... And it's foreshadowed fairly early on in the first couple of chapters that there is definitely a price.
Because one of the things that I think is kind of quite interesting with Sherlock stories and things, because if you think the ones that we all know tend to be like a murder mystery, so it is a case of like, here's an improbable thing, can you make sense of it? And he takes it and he does make sense of it. But we seem to see now the creations of stories where it's not just, here's a thing that doesn't make sense, make it make sense, that now it is also, make it make sense, and if you can solve the issue... which obviously you don't get with a murder mystery. You're never going to be able to unmurder someone. And to an extent that, because I often wonder about that, because in the way that I see the character of who Sherlock Holmes is, I don't know if A, he'd care enough, or B, if he'd see that as being the job, is trying to like create a complete ending.
He's presented with, we're again about spoiling it, presented with a series of impossible. I mean, one of the things I like about Barker, when he's building his worlds, is they're impossible worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, you know, they don't make sense as a world. And then mankind looks at these impossible worlds and goes, "No, I want to work at the call center 9 to 5. Thank you very much. Bye." And you know, because typically, mankind's response to these weird wonderlands is to either embrace it fully and be destroyed, or to run screaming. And I could talk about Clive Barker, I could talk about metaphors for fetishes and for also certain lifestyle choices and this sort of thing. And also for feeling the outside, being the outsider as well. And there's a whole separate thing where you can talk about Clive Barker and sexuality as well, which is a separate kettle of fish that I'm not even going to dive into, but you could argue
weird image diving into a kettle of fish.
But there's always like it's always in the back of your mind, that sort of kind of that those other worlds, those worlds that you're not allowed to, that society says you shouldn't be anywhere near. And the thing about Sherlock is that he's an outsider, and the thing about the victims of the Xenobites is they tend to be outsiders because that's what they do. They take people who are vulnerable in certain ways and offer them terrible, terrible deals and these terrible things. It's great as jam. I would say it's huge pulp. It's a massive pulp novel. I mean, we're not afraid to do pulp books in this. But then I would also argue that, and I might get a funny look from some people, that Sherlock at the time was pulp.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, and therefore, as you could argue that Clive Barker, as a creator of very popular pulp horror, who then went on to write not some pulpy horror, and as Conan Doyle, creator of very popular cult crime drama, you get this interesting mix.
Well, Sherlock originally was published weekly in The Strand, wasn't it? It was the weekly cliffhanger thing, in the same way that Dickens was, sort of however many years earlier he was.
Shall we do a quick advert?
Let's do a quick advert.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
So, Sherlock. There's an awful lot of... I don't know, why is it that we're so... grabbed and then, you know, Sherlock's just faced hell, the poor sod, you know.
Is Sherlock one of those enduring characters because he's one of those people that we know some stuff about, but there's so much of his life that's mystery? Because the thing about sort of original stories, I think, is that you've got this core of action of whatever the story, the mystery is in the middle, and Sherlock and Watson are dancing around the edge of it and just sort of Sherlock's poking it every so often, so he's not generally in this glob of plot in the middle.
I think that Sherlock has become an archetype of a character. I think since the success of these stories over the last century and a chunk, he's a character that just gets recreated and delved into quite a lot, but also you can morph him to meet the time. You can use Sherlock for any kind of zeitgeist. One of my very best friends is a Sherlock Holmes fan, but she's quite a purist, and she gets really annoyed with most modern adaptations of various things. To be honest, I don't think that she dislikes the current BBC stuff of the last few years, but it's things like she doesn't like that Irene Adler is a focal character. She doesn't particularly like that Mary becomes an important character, and that's the same in like the Robert Downey Jr. films as well. Because in her head, she's like, they're not really in them. It's like, I don't know why they're now important. Whereas my point, because I'm going to be honest,
characters are nice to have.
I was like, I've not read any of the books. I don't know that. I was like, but to an extent, in a modern story, a man walking around being clever isn't enough anymore. Human elements are really important, and it's those characters that make those. As much as Sherlock is intriguing because he's almost inhuman, what we like is when we see those little human elements, and it's stuff like the Irene Adler story and the Stephen Moffat and series that really kind of get you in there. And it's not that he's got an indefeatable foe that's the interesting thing about Moriarty. It's the fact that Moriarty, again, makes him human when he's almost inhuman. Having squabbles with your brother, it's like these are the things that actually draw you in to a character, and I do get that. I think in this, the way that the modern audience currently works, those things are what are important to keep perpetuating that man. But he is a character that it doesn't matter what era we've been in since he's been created, you can fit him to what is current in storytelling at that time.
I'm going to respond to a couple of points. One, because I have read the original stories. Yeah, let's stay away from the word canon in this case, because... argument! But, insert argument, contact, you know, Ed, by the usual channels. He likes the arguments more than me. But if you do read the short stories, I mean, the first Sherlock Holmes stories, there are two serialised novels, and then there are collections of short stories, and the first of them is the one featuring Irene Adler, and it is the one in which Watson says to him, she will always be the woman. Whether it simply is people who've read the stories, and that's the first one they read, because that's the first of the short stories, and didn't continue past that point, and she is made to be a lasting presence as far as that story is concerned. Maybe that's where It takes a life of its own from her, even though she doesn't appear again in the stories. So that he's also not really an outsider. He does, you know, he does travel around London a lot. He acquires tremendous amounts of local knowledge about London, about the kinds of things he's going to do. Scientific knowledge include one of the early books has him describing, he's catalogued all these different kinds of cigarette ash because it's going to be useful to know which kind of cigarettes come from where or what kind of mud you get in different parts of London. He's not all knowing because he has no interest in things like the solar system, which is referred to in the original series. It's been riffed off by Moffat and others.
Mm.
But he's not interested in all knowledge, just that which focuses on his work. And he's not tremendously an outsider. He boxes, he does all these other things in order to acquire this wealth of knowledge which helps him in all of the cases where the police can't. Beyond that, it's been described as he has the most achievable superpower, which is he observes things and he deduces things from them. And it's just a simple detail of, if you pay attention to the world around you, you could be like him. You can go into the realms of mental conditions, I don't know what the best term for that is, whether you would psychologically classify Holmes as they've done in recent interpretations. But it is an achievable power if he wants to do it. So I'm not saying...
That's what I like about Elementary, is the fact that you see him learning stuff. So you see him with a big board of padlocks that he's added to and learning stuff all about the padlocks. And you see him watching 1,200 TV screens and learning what's going on in all those plots and shows and all the rest of it. I like that. And I like with Elementary, the human elements of the fact that you do know more about Holmes and Watson and all of the other characters.
One of the things I really like about Elementary, and they touch on it in Sherlock as well, is his weaknesses. And it's actually something that the Servants of Hell do quite well as well, where when he comes back from Reichenbach in the Servants of Hell, he throws himself even into further training and into further limits and pushes himself beyond the levels of sense, if you see what I mean. So he essentially takes the Victorian equivalent of the Iron Man challenge and goes off and does, you know, incredibly crazy stuff. And I think the problem, because we're all like, that's achievable. You know, he has a superpower. His superpower is he's a super genius. He learns at an incredible rate. And it's interesting to see that the Victorian era Sherlock is pretty much indomitable. And all the later adaptations, he's not indomitable. He's just very strong and clever. And we're moving away from the man knows everything and is always right. Here's my pipe. Sort of cliche. I think we hit peak that cliche sometime in the 50s and 60s, and then we started laughing at it because it was so ridiculous. And I think part of that was nuclear, where the image of there were lots of men in pipes who were very well learned were like, atomic power is the future, and then cancer.
But the Jeremy Brett TV show actor, the Granada 80s Granada adaptation of Sherlock Holmes for TV is utterly faithful and isn't taking the mick. And it's doing it seriously. And it's brilliant. And Jeremy Brett's performance as Sherlock is regarded by a lot of people as the definitive on-screen version.
I think one of the keys to his current endurance, despite the fact that Elementary and Sherlock strip him of that element, but it's not noteworthy that they do, is Victorian romance.
Mm.
Because, I mean... Certainly, Servants of Hell wouldn't work in the modern day because all of the, you know, because creatures and leather and chains, that's a bit risky, sort of take on it really works in a Victorian setting. And the Victorian setting, I think, is one of the reasons why people keep coming back to it. And it's not a setting, it's just when the stories were written, it was an innately Victorian. But we have no real kind of grasp of what life was like that then, really, despite going to a museum, you can kind of Whereas reading this kind of pulp fiction about the Victorian period kind of tells you more about what they thought of themselves. And it's sort of comforting that they were very similar to you know, now. Mm. But yes, Sherlock is... there's also that thing where if without Sherlock Holmes, you wouldn't have the Doctor. You wouldn't. No one would have invented the Doctor if you didn't have Sherlock Holmes, because he's this clever genius guy who runs around and fixes things.
We wouldn't have Basil the Great Mouse Detective. And that's an amazing film.
That is the best adaptation.
I really love it. Like, so much. I know it's Disney and copyright, and so it's not called Sherlock, and they've stayed away from various bits, but it's such a good film. I love it so much. It's one, I actually think it's one of my favourite Disneys, and it just gets forgotten, but it's glorious.
Young Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, Young Sherlock Holmes!
I like Young Sherlock Holmes.
I like Young Sherlock Holmes! But I think it's because I was so little the first time I watched it, so I think it's got a lot of nostalgia. When it comes on, I'm like, oh yeah! I remember watching this on a Sunday afternoon, because I just find it on one of the four channels that existed.
Yep.
We've had the Hound of the Baskervilles with the Sherlock TV series.
And there was one a few years ago with Ian Watson. No, not Ian Watson.
The crazy guy who now lives in Spain.
Ian Hart. He played Quirrell in Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Just a British actor, but he was Watson. And that was... I think that came out about the same time as Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. They did a Hound of the Baskervilles TV thing. It was either a mini series or like a one-off 2-hour special, but that I really enjoyed that. I thought that was really good. That was that it was a like time appropriate to the story, like it was a
period.
It was like a period adaptation.
I think Hound of the Baskervilles is one of those ones that I really like as a story, but it's also kind of disappointing because obviously I wanted to be a werewolf. And
we've had a story.
Yeah.
And it's a gift to pulp writers everywhere, where it's like, let's rewrite this, but let's make it a Martian. Let's rewrite this, but let's make it Body Snatchers. Let's rewrite put it on the holodeck, or let's rewrite it, and so on. Or let's just give the reader what he wants and make it a werewolf. Let's make Watson the werewolf. Hey! And off we go.
It's like Max Payne, isn't it? Max Payne is a much more interesting story when you think there's genuinely supernatural beings controlling humanity, and then it's like, oh, it's just drugs. Oh, it was drugs in the end, after all.
Scooby-Doo wouldn't have worked at all. We think it's the janitor in a mask. Yeah, okay, it is.
The Hound of the Baskervilles, with Scooby-Doo as the hound, and the Mystery Machine crew working with Holmes and Watson.
Well, that'd be a mess.
Watson would just be Shaggy's carer.
Scrappy-Doo would be the hound.
Of course he would.
Surely the hound would be some guy under a sheet who would have got away with it if it weren't for your meddling kids.
That's...
The owner of the moors.
Isn't that, in fact, the Hound of the Baskervilles anyway?
Sherlock Holmes would have gotten away with it if he hadn't been a few million kids.
Ah!
We've just spoiled the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah. It's been out for 100 years.
Does that mean we can spoil Shakespeare?
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. I'm gonna find some 10-year-olds.
There was this brilliant thing.
And spoil Shakespeare to them. Please end that sentence.
There was this brilliant...
That's going to
come. There was this brilliant... There was this brilliant thing with Lizzie Bennet Diaries when people were watching it who hadn't read Pride and Prejudice and didn't know how it ended, who like were just commenting and just going mad, and you were just like, oh. And the same thing happened with Autobiography of Jane Eyre, which is the people who hadn't read the book and didn't know what was coming were going, oh, this is really lovely with the Christmas and stuff. And the rest of us are going, they're just about the point in the book where we have to find out Bamsey's watched it, and oh my god, it's going to be awful! And it was.
Doom.
And you just sit there going,
I had that when we sat down one Christmas to watch some Agatha Christie, and I was like, oh, this is set on a train.
Oh, yeah, this was brilliant. This was the other year. This was Murder on the Orient Express, and you had no clue what the plot was. And I was sat there going,
hadn't read it.
And you got to the end, and you were like, what?
Yeah, I think what? Because when people think about Agatha Christie, they think of like quaint British Miss Marple, and actually a lot of them are very dark.
Oh,
and then, there were none, is insane. Oh, and Agatha Christie wrote, she wrote the novel, she wrote the play, and she wrote the TV. Did she write the TV thing? Am I wrong there?
I think it might be she wrote certain movie adaptation.
Oh, that's it, movie adaptation. So, yeah, so the book, the play, and the TV adaptation, and they each have a different ending, and each of them are dark. I didn't see the one that was on, was it this Christmas or last Christmas? I wanted to, but it was just on at an awkward time. And I'm sure I will find it one day. But, yeah, it's just that, yeah, every single one is different. Every single one is horrid. The theatre script has a slightly lighter ending, but the film is harrowing. Like,
did you see the TV version over Christmas?
No.
Oh, it's very good.
had that conversation.
But they messed with it again. But they messed with it.
And then they were none though. Is kind of an archetype again. A lot of where Sherlock. What is it about that kind of period of crime drama? But
the golden age of detective fiction.
Indeed, golden age of detective fiction, where because Sherlock is the prime character for, and you can look at lots of other characters, especially in pulp fiction, and go, that's Luther is basically Sherlock with some massive modifications. For example, and that's just the first one off the top of my head. You can go through a long list of, you know, detective models and say that's it's modelled on Sherlock, and then there were none. We would not have a whole host of horror movie and science fiction movies, aliens, and then there were none. I know that's a horrible way of putting it. It's like, what? No, what are you saying? It's like, no, it's a bunch of people who are trapped and isolated, who die one by one, and then they have to work out why they are dying. Now, an alien, it's because there's an alien, clues in the title. Pitch Black is Alien meets And Then There Were None, because again, here are a bunch of individuals, they're all gonna die.
And it's just that idea of telling them how as well, like, the pretty much the first thing that happens is when they get to the house is that they all realize that they don't know each other. The host isn't here, oh look at this weird poem, like, and then to know, once you work out the pattern and realise it's connected to the poem, just knowing that poem is not enough.
Actually, I think, you know, I've suddenly realised I'm wrong. I think the criteria for to claim that something is based on none and then there were none is for there to be foreshadowing of all the deaths in advance.
A foreshadowing of each death, all getting picked off one by one, not knowing who's going to be next, and even though you've got that foreshadowing, not being able to know how it's going to happen and therefore what to avoid.
I was about to say, someone should do a parody of it, and then I realised that's a clue.
And yes. Family Guy have done they have had a big long episode called And Then There Were Fewer. It's really funny.
Oh, I like the grammar in that sentence. I love Clue. I love Clue the movie. Absolutely love it.
That's Tim Curry, isn't it?
It is.
But we veered away from books into board games somehow. Well, definitely in the movies, but certainly in the board games. So, have we come to any conclusion? Of course we haven't.
No.
I don't think you ever would.
But so what crossovers would we like to see? What hasn't been done? Or what do we not know has been done? Because it probably has been done somewhere.
Sherlock Holmes and the Missing Cookies. It could be like the Muppet Babies of Sherlock Holmes. go younger than young Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, my word.
Weirdly, I was... And we'll talk about this on... We'll talk about Edgelit itself on another show. But weirdly, I was talking to David Tallman who writes The Giant Thief and a whole bunch of other really cool stuff. And we were talking about different crime dramas, and we'd got on the subject of Lucifer. And Lucifer, the TV series, is an excellent replacement for the TV show Castle and a rubbish version of the M.R. Carey novels. But we were like, well, who else could you pair it up instead of Lucifer? It's like, well, maybe the Cookie Monster. But Sherlock Holmes and the Cookie Monster, but the Cookie Monster is Watson, would be...
Oh, I love this.
And maybe the Count as Sherlock, with the Deer Stalker. Or Kermit, obviously. Kermit would like.
Haven't the Muppets done a Sherlock Holmes thing?
They have to have.
I'm sure they have. Christmas Carol?
No.
Sorry.
Maybe they should definitely do that as a movie. They don't do those movie things anymore, but they should do that one. Hound of the Baskervilles. Fuzzy Bear would be Watson.
Yeah, but Miss Piggy would be Irene.
Miss Piggy feminist icon.
Amazing. So but Kermit would definitely be Holmes. Who do you think would be Watson?
Fozzie.
Really? Fozzie's not. Gonzo. I do want. Fozzie is my favourite, but it would be Gonzo, I think.
Fozzie would be Lestrade.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right.
Fozzie is not second in command. Fozzie would be Lestrade. Waka waka. I love Fozzie. Very much.
So, what other crossovers can we have? Obviously, Sherlock meets Danger Mouse. The world's greatest... actually, Basil the Mouse Detective
meets Danger Mouse.
Anne is very excited.
Muppet Sherlock Holmes is a four-part comic book miniseries released in 2010 as part of the Muppet Comics line from Boom Studios. The comic is a spoof of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories, with each issue to date titled after and directly, if often loosely, reworking a specific canonic story. The series stars Gonzo as Holmes, with Fozzie Bear as Dr. Watson, Kermit the Frog as Inspector Lestrade.
What?
We've got it completely wrong.
No, I've got it wrong.
And Miss Piggy in various female leads, including Irene Adler.
Oh dear.
Whoops.
So, who would you have as Moriarty, though?
I'm trying to work out what the first story is called. Is it A Study in Felt?
The Adventure Bunsen? Of the Speckled Band.
See, I don't know, because the Muppet films, I think the baddie would probably be some kind of current big film star, wouldn't it? Moriarty would be the
absolutely.
Person.
Yes.
The real person.
Rolf the dog is Mycroft Holmes.
I love Rolf! Ah! Fozzie would be Lestrade, but to an extent, I kind of would like Bunsen to be Lestrade just because of having Beaker running around crime scenes.
Rizzo would be Billy.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah,
I've just remembered Paul Cannell has done two Sherlock Holmes things. He did an episode of Elementary, which I think is the episode of Elementary of all the comic books in, which I really enjoyed. And he's just got a book out called Who Killed Sherlock Holmes, which I think is one of his Shadow Police stories. And the way the Shadow Police stories work is they're coppers who don't understand magic at all, but they're in a kind of gaming-esque kind of world where magic is just, or Clive Barker-esque world where magic is just kind of behind closed doors. So as police detectives, there's apparently a moment where they're sitting there going, so how is it a ghost bus? How does a bus die? I'm going to, like, on a pinboard in the front of my car. I've just gone on a tangent. So.
Crossover I would want to see, just because I think it would be horrible and awful. Like, I don't think it would be good, but I'd love the idea of sitting down and working out how these characters would interact. But, like, a literal Sherlock Holmes and Constantine, like, case... Like, exactly,
oh
that
word.
Face. Like, how, like, can you, like, even trying to work out how they would work together? Like,
they'd kill each other.
Okay, so it's got to be modern day because Constantine doesn't work in the Victorian setting.
No.
Because he's a scouse dogger and therefore gets ignored. Because his class becomes too much of an issue.
Yeah.
So it's got to be modern day. So let's pick let's pick Sherlock from the Sherlock TV series, because he'd be okay in Elementary
or otherworldly, modern day or something otherworld. Like, Constantine's done other dimensions. If you think like the Books of Magic by Neil Gaiman.
So it's good, but it's if it was the archetypical, it'd be interesting because Constantine would stand there and being arrogant. Oh, actually, yeah. isn't Sherlock's trick to know a lot about your history?
Mm.
So somehow he'd be like, you've done something horrible and you're trying to make up for it.
Mm.
And he would know that straight away because it's Sherlock and he would get the measure of the man straight away. And he's like, I don't know. Because he's, right, he would not understand all the data because Sherlock doesn't do magic. So he wouldn't understand any of the information, or half the information there because it's like, but he would probably pass it off as occult practice because he probably knows enough about that to go, so you're involved in occult practice, you're a confidence trickster, you're incredibly guilty about something, probably someone young, because that's the sort of leaps of deduction he goes for. So he'd probably assume that he was some sort of dangerous, insane criminal, and then probably try and disassociate as quickly as possible. Because he'd see John Constantine as incredibly dangerous in the first place.
Yeah.
And John would try and use Sherlock front and centre because Sherlock punches bad guys and tends to run forward into it. So John would herd Sherlock into danger and not give that much of a fig about the consequences.
Mm.
So John Constantine would get Sherlock killed, but Sherlock is too clever to get killed.
Okay, if we introduce Sherlock Holmes to a story with actual supernatural elements, that Sherlock would somehow be sceptical and would not actually believe the supernatural elements existed, rather than being an expert on supernatural elements, because that would influence a lot of the crime in his area. Wouldn't Sherlock actually know more about the occult if it actually existed?
So hang on.
But in Constantine world, like, a lot of the stories are kind of real world based, aren't they? It's just the idea that there's things about the world that we don't think about or see. Like all the, you're looking at me like I'm mental.
No, I'm trying to.
Like, it's almost like the background world, isn't it? Like,
I think actually it's an interesting point because the adventure, you know, Sherlock Holmes meets John Constantine. Adventure 1, Adventure 2, Sherlock Holmes finds a Grimoire, cracks it open, applies all his engines to working out how that works, and then in the same way that, you know, he knows enough fake judo to hold his own in a fight, he probably know enough magic, but then you're heading into realms of being a wizard. So yeah, it'd be interesting because would he embrace those magical elements? Would he cast a divination spell because it's now another tool in his arsenal, and he picks up all these skills in a world where the supernatural is a thing? That said, Conan Doyle never added a spiritualism element to Holmes, even though he was a spiritualist himself.
Mm.
So there is that too. That's interesting. How would Sherlock deal with magic in a magic-rich world?
Embrace magic, we potentially find ourselves with a character similar to like the boss in Ben Aronarovich's world. I can't say it properly. But in like Rivers of London, that's because that's the first one, isn't it? Where we're learning about how this magic world works.
He would become a quintessential English magus.
Yeah.
I think Charlie Strauss also touches on that as an idea where, you know, a very, very intelligent people, super intelligent genius types, who are smart enough to go, who are introduced to magic enough, old enough to go, well, this is horrible and it'll get me killed. So I will approach it in the same way that I would approach poisonous material or atomic material or anything else that can get me killed. I mean, getting back to the book we're talking about at the top of the show, Sherlock's response to the occult, and that is to pretty much be broken by it to an extent, but that's because magic in that world is horrible. And it also depends on what the nature of the magic is. You know, if it was Marvel Comics, then Sherlock would be like, right, and be able to summon Thor to help them out and that sort of nonsense.
Well, yeah, I'm just pointing out, you know, that in a world where, you know, Sherlock is capable of categorising, you know, 100 different types of cigarette ash, he would also be categorising 100 different types of mouse species blood, you know, and what they would foot before. So, you know, this would be part of his knowledge. Because magic exists.
I've examined these different types of sage, and I find that witches from this part of the world use this in their rituals. Because you kind of, Ben Ivanovich and also Paul Cornell's stuff are two examples of that sort of detective occult drama mix. Yes. Whatever. Basil the Great Mouse Detective and Danger Mouse obviously has to be a crossover. Doctor and Sherlock, just to give Stephen Moffat more work to do.
But I don't know if that, because they don't really normally do fictional, do they, with Doctor Who?
Well, so he's,
they meet,
he's posed
they meet
as Sherlock
authors, but they don't necessarily meet fictionals, because it's about history, isn't it?
They've played with it. I think he's.
Children need special, wouldn't it?
Like Red Dwarf did an episode where they found themselves on a planet full of replicant celebrities who genuinely. Because it was a theme park world or something, wasn't it?
Yes.
And then all the people left, but they left the celebrity robots there.
and they built their own society, and all the evil. All the dictators got on one side, and it was like. And Albert Einstein and Marilyn Monroe on the other side, and it was all a total mess. God, that was a terrible episode of television. We should talk to an author about what they're doing now. Shall we do that?
Sure.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so Piers Maron, welcome to the book.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, tell us about your latest one.
So my latest book, Morning Star, is the last book in the Red Rising trilogy. Red Rising Trilogy is about a young man named Darrow who is rebelling against an oppressive regime in space. And he is waging a war for love, not for revenge, but to right this wrong that happened to him when he was 16. And the book starts, Red Rising starts when he's 16, and then Morning Star is when he's 23. So we've seen a boy become a man through the course of this. And this is set in a society that is very Romanesque. It's like, imagine Romans have colonized 700 years in the future, have colonized the planets and moons of the solar system and have created a rigid class hierarchy. This is about someone who's at the bottom of the civilization, infiltrating the top of the civilization in order to bring it down from the inside. And book three is really the sum of all the storylines coming together, and it's the actual rebellion. So, that's...
So, why ancient Rome as your inspiration?
There's several reasons. One, I read all about Rome when I was a kid. And one of my first coloring books was actually of the Trojan War. So I've always been influenced by antiquity. Now, I thought the shields were purple when I was about 7 years old, but my parents were pretty good about steering me towards the humanism in general, so Western, the origins of Western thought. And I was in love with the Iliad and the Odyssey. As stories when I was young, because I had these great set of books. It was about 80 books called The Great Classics Abridged. And so they had all the classics in Western civilization, or many of them, and they were written for 9-year-olds. And so I was able to read them.
In as brief as possible, how would you sell the Red Rising series to my elderly grandmother?
I would say that it is the Count of Monte Cristo meets... a Dune or a Star Wars. And so you have the politics, you have adventure, you have love, romance, but you also have, the idea of a man having to impersonate someone else in order to bring down something that is corrupt, which is this government.
Red Rising is a massive hit. Why do you think the fans have responded so well, and what are the fans telling you about your books?
I think they've responded because when you're creating a story, you're trying to create a feeling, a tone, this lifeblood that kind of flows. This is what happened with Harry Potter, with Lord of the Rings, with this almost like zeitgeist that exists independent of the book and independent of me. And I think that people have kind of captured on this. I've given them a home away from their own home, and the characters who are almost like friends to them. And so with Darrow, Severo, Mustang, these are characters that people want to just see exist.
What is your... Why science fiction? Why did you take the science fiction approach with the story? Because it's the sort of story that can fit almost anywhere, shouldn't it?
Yeah, it could. I mean, it's a story that's been told before in a lot of different ways, but the telling is always going to be different depending on what time you were in. I think science fiction because I'm so influenced by sci-fi, Star Wars, Dune, Hyperion series by Dan Simmons. These wonderful, wonderful books were my childhood. And so this always felt like the thing I was meant to write, this grand space opera. But science fiction also gives us the ability to talk about things in our own society without stepping on political toes. And so I can talk about injustices, but not preach about it. Because if you talk about things now, you're almost always preaching. You know, if you talk about the political climate of the United States or Britain or wherever, this is my way of commenting on something without necessarily taking a political stance and urging someone to vote for a particular candidate.
Skirting around politics slightly, why are we staring at the stars now? Why is sci-fi so big again?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've definitely returned to a point where we're talking about space travel, we're talking about science fiction. You know, it's no longer a secret to be a fan of Star Wars. Why has that happened?
The explosion of technology, I think, is greatly responsible. Because it's been easier to make films set in space, easier to make films that are comic book or sci-fi related because of the special effects you can have, but also because I think of the dissemination of pop culture. You know, comic books are so much easy to access. Books are easier to access than they have ever been before. And so I think that these are stories that excite people, particularly with, you know, the rover on Mars, with, you know, Martian became so popular at that time, captured the zeitgeist, because we're looking forward. And I think mankind is always looking forward, but we relapse for little periods of time. You know, we took about 30 years, 20 years off before realizing that we are explorers, and it's in our nature to, if it's there, we want to climb it. If it's there, we want to go to it. And I think sci-fi appeals to the better aspirations of man, and sometimes the greedier ones.
What's your next big project?
Next big project. So I have several things I'm working on for TV and film, hopefully the film Red Rising. So I've done the first two drafts for Universal. Mark Forster of World War Z is directing. And then I'm doing three more books in the Red Rising world. These are set 10 years after the events of the last book, Morning Star, which is out now. And they have some of the same characters in different perspectives. But I want to expand the world and, you know, let people live in that home a little while longer.
What? Obviously, your influence is limited as just the writer when it comes to production of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But what are the things that you want to see out of the movie? What are the, in your head, when you were writing the book, what are
besides
the
badass space battles?
Exactly.
Well, badass space battles. And then I think the most important thing is capturing the feeling. I mean, the best adaptations, in my mind, are Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, in terms of sci-fi and fantasy. And they're such good adaptations, not because they follow the exact plot, but because they capture the spirit. You know, with Middle-earth, it's the dying of magic. Elves leaving Middle-earth, and then who inherits it? And it's about hope coming from the most unexpected source, the Hobbit, you know, or Hobbits. And then Harry Potter, it's that sense of home and in the comfort of friends. And they captured that, and you felt it live on screen. For Red Rising, it would be capturing the camaraderie in the face of overwhelming odds. And so almost like a Lawrence of Arabia in space. That's what Mark Forster wants to make, and it's what I want to see.
If you had the chance to play in someone else's creative sandpit, which sandpit would you choose?
Ooh, Star Wars. Any time. Mostly because I so desperately want to write a Dark Jedi, or The Fall of a Jedi. It'd be so fun.
If you could bring back a series that we don't have with us anymore,
mm-hmm.
what would that be? Books, TV.
I mean, I think Sequest is a massively underappreciated show that it doesn't even have the cult following it should have. Maybe for a reason. I would love to bring back Xena. Xena would be amazingly fun to write. It'd be amazingly fun to develop, to shoot. You know, it'd be having set in New Zealand again would be awesome.
If you bumped into a 16-year-old version of yourself and you had just enough time to say one significant thing, apart from, you know, the obvious reassurances, what would it be?
Don't eat the nachos.
Miss Brown, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, that was lovely.
What a lovely author.
I think we've run out of time.
Oh. And we came to no conclusions ever, apart from it'd be nice to see this.
We should now all go off and write our own crossovers. I'm thinking Sherlock and Transformers. So it's a goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
Bye.
Bye.